You're listening to KEPW.
Is cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. All right, today, part two of Colin Doyle from the Lost Valley Educational Center right here in Dexter, Oregon, right down the highway. They're still open during the deforestation virus pandemic. And I'm going to start it back with the talking about greenwashing. And then he has some solutions. And speaking of solutions, I've scored an interview with Michael Schumann. I got this from the Sustainable Economies Law Center. Is, you know, you want to follow the money. The one thing, whether you believe in capitalism or communism or whatever, you want to follow the money. The most effective way I've seen of making changes to take away the money from the corporate oligarchs. And Michael Schumann just wrote a book called Investing, Put Your Money Where Your Life Is. And it's about putting your retirement money into co-ops and other grassroots organizations instead of, because when you look at sustainable investing, the only place you can put your money is in corporations, like and tech stocks is what they're investing in, calling that sustainable because it's not war that you're investing in. So coming up in the next few weeks, I'm going to have several interviews in that genre, in that vein of investing in co-ops. I've also scored an interview with a solar co-op here in Eugene. So, and then just one bit of commentary for you here. I'm noticing on NPR, and I'm not saying don't listen to NPR, but I notice they keep talking about Biden's not even in office yet, and they're talking about a pivot to Russia. And this is very dangerous. We need to concentrate on stopping corporate outsourcing of jobs to China, and especially the Green New Deal should be the main focus, and creating green jobs. Otherwise, I can almost guarantee you there will be a return of a Trump of some kind if Biden does not stay with the plan of new Green New Deal jobs. So NPR is constantly talking about Russia and, pivoting toward Russia. And so you'll probably see a war with Ukraine in Russia. Big mistake. All right, so, coming up, Colin Doyle of the Lost Valley Education Center here at Dexter, Oregon, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Support independent media. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
So what's the difference between true, real sustainability and the sustainability that's used for greenwashing?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that that term is approaching the end of its use. It sounds like it's gotten overly used by PR firms and self-interested individuals. It's kind of sad and funny to me that there's even a debate about what sustainability means, because it's quite clear to me that it is an objective standard. It is the ability to sustain something indefinitely. And so I think of that as being at least 20,000 years straight, because history of agriculture is around 10,000 years, and it's not working and sustainably.
Or seven generations, at least.
Yeah.
Not 20,000 years, but...
Yeah. An extremely long period of time, which is far longer than our usual mentality in this society. And I noticed that, like, a few years ago, I was on a trip in Italy, and I went to the... It was in Milan. We went to the main kind of feature there, which is this huge cathedral called the Duomo. And it took 500 years to build. And how many people in this country are now engaging in practices that would take 500 years? I'm going to start a 500-year project. Nobody thinks like that.
Well, what the Sahara Desert 10,000 years ago was a forest.
And my understanding is the Fertile Crescent was fertile at the time, which now it's just a desert.
And so, because of human activity, though, because of change in climate.
Right. So to me, sustainability is something that you can do indefinitely. And there's various kind of layers of that. And on the ecological side of sustainability, like the three-dimensional world, which is what we're talking about, trees, for example, you mentioned, that is almost nothing is sustainable on that level. There is renewable. Trees are renewable, especially in this ecosystem where they do grow back well, but renewable is not sustainable. So, for example, you could have a logging company that's cutting down trees. Even if it's a selective cut, they're only cutting every other tree in a given area. Well, to be sustainable, everything in that whole chain of production needs to be sustained. Like, how did the logging truck come to be there? Because of mining minerals somewhere in the world and transporting them and smelting them and running the fuel to make it happen and all these things. So nowhere near genuine, meaningful sustainability, which is what Rob Bowman from Maitreya Ecovillage in Eugene uses as his term. But there's various things that get closer and closer to that. For example, in 2003, I moved to a tiny indigenous village in Venezuela, South America, and there, life is way closer to what we would call sustainable, because it was for thousands of years until outside influences came in. And now they do engage in agriculture, and they have clothes and soap and machetes and things like that, outside things, but far less than us. And so if there's a spectrum, I think of it as like a number line, a spectrum of sustainability, where the goal is you could do this for 20,000 years. Traditionally, they were in that camp, and now they are far closer to that than we are. And the sad thing is that our society, and therefore the rest of the world, as the rest of the world follows America, is getting further and further from the target. It's like the chasm is growing wider and wider. And so if a place like Lost Valley is a few notches better than that, well, then we're still being pulled in the wrong direction, in a sense, not in the right direction. And so as far as the greenwashing goes, that's just really sad to me. And it's emblematic of a society that's in it for itself. Like, I want to use this term because it gives me some kind of cachet. Also because there's no enforcement of the term. So the term like organic, there is a definition for it. You can ask the FDA and they'll give you the definition on their website, for example. And that can be enforced if somebody's puts on their packaging organic and it's not. They can be penalized for that. Whereas there is no body in the U.S. or anywhere else that's enforcing what sustainability actually is. So people can just go with it. They can just run with that term, and nobody's actually there to stop them, except the broader society. And the broader society generally isn't the ones paying millions of dollars to PR firms to do anything with that. And so
we can't afford to do that.
Yeah, and it was sad for me once a few years ago. A sort of like really good example in my experience was I was driving on I-5 and had to go to this truck stop because the truck I was driving broke down, needed a tire change, and I was sitting there and was seeing a bunch of semis and whatnot refueling. And there was one of them that had painted on the side of it, it was so-and-so Brothers Trucking, 50 years of sustainable transport solutions, I think is what it said. And I was just, and I have a strong stomach, and if I didn't, I might have just vomited on the site, because that is so far from what actual sustainability is. It's like the logging truck. It's a huge truck moving this stuff. Even just one of the tires for that is an immense amount of energy. And if you took that tire off, you buried it halfway in the ground and put it in a kid's playground, they would bounce on it for the next 30 years. And that's just one of the tires.
Right, this is the concept of embodied energy.
Yeah, embodied energy. And even the paint that the word sustainability was written in was probably an oil-based paint that was extracted from the ground in, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or somewhere else. So even the paint that the word sustainable was written in wasn't sustainable. So that's just a great snippet of how this term is being lost. And so then the question comes up of what do we do? Do we abandon this word? And it sounds like it's getting closer and closer to that point. I tend to retain it, and this program that we're running still has the word sustainability in the name because that's what the real goal is. Or do we need to say, okay, like the bad guys, so to speak, have gotten that word, and we need to go on to a new word, like regenerative is now being used.
No, I think you should sue them for false advertising. That's not accurate use of the term.
It isn't, yeah. And I guess, am I going to, you know, take...
They've co-opted a term, and that's not...
So I agree, and am I going to spend tens of thousands of dollars and 4 years in court to try to sue one company for one use of a term? So, it's challenging.
Well, but so, you mentioned the machete, and to me, sustainability is in staying within a cycle. Hmm. So I don't see, you're not against technology, you're in favor of appropriate technology.
Yeah, appropriate technology, which is a part of permaculture and how you do things.
I mean, a feller buncher is not appropriate technology. It laid off, it took the place of whatever, 20 jobs to put and cutting things with a feller buncher, whereas horse logging, not now, it's too late for horse logging now, but I mean, horse logging we would have been okay with, maybe.
Yeah, I've seen it done, like it's happened in Upper Vecho, in Cottage Grove, but now it's hard to compete with fossil fuels at this point. So if somebody wants to do something that's an alternative, it becomes more of like a boutique sort of thing, and people have to pay extra for it. And that's the past, and that's the future. I think that's where we're going, whether we want to or not. Things like horse logging. You know, 200 years from now, I don't think we're going to be using, you know, clear cuts.
And we certainly don't need fossil fuels anymore.
So that's tricky, and then this gets into a whole other angle of like, okay, now much of the world is eating fossil fuels. That's how we sustain ourselves. In a sense, we're eating oil. And so if oil was gone overnight, there would be some kind of die-off, it seems like, because we're so vastly overpopulated. So we're getting this kind of catch-22 where we can't continue in the current system, but if we change the system, it's going to be a hard crash. So, ..
Right, but we could move away from... I mean, they're not... They subsidize oil. If they use the same amount of subsidies that they give oil as they do, if they gave that to solar, I think we could move quite rapidly away from fossil fuels.
That's a great.
I mean, let me give you my experience is that the subsidies for solar, what they're doing is building solar plants in the middle of the desert and then running a line to your house instead of doing rooftop solar. And that's where all the money is going. To this day, I can't get solar panels on my house. Mm. There's no, or if there is a program, there's a huge line to get it. So, whereas there was no direct subsidy for oil for years, but every war that we've fought in the 20th century, at least, and the 21st, has been for oil. So there's a subsidy with people's lives.
Right.
But... So I digress.
Yeah, I think you're right, though, because a way I've heard economics described is a series of incentives and disincentives. And so that's what you're speaking to, is like rebates, for example, for rooftop solar you're finding hard to get, and yet some, you know, company with millions of dollars in capital can create a solar farm in a desert and then run a line somewhere else.
And charge me for power that I could make for free. Mm-hmm. But so go on.
Yeah, and then this is getting into a question of do the powers that be want people to be sort of independent and resilient? You know, if you had a system on your roof, perhaps you would be off grid, which would be great for you. And you're also not giving anybody any money, and you're not dependent on anybody else in that particular way. So they don't have as much on you, so to speak. So what do we value in our society? A certain amount of like independence, which we say we value, but as individual units of resiliency, which could be an individual household, could be a community, could be a town or something, or is it more of a large system that is all tied together through the grid, for example, something like that. It has a certain amount of efficiency to it, but is a centralized body and is an automatically very fragile system.
Well, and it's just that I don't know what period I could attribute this to, but even, you know, the first computers were made to where you could repair them yourself. Mm. And now we've moved to you cannot repair a cell phone yourself, and you can't do anything by yourself, or the guy down the street can't really fix it. Even farmers are having troubles with their combines. They have to call up International Harvester to get the software to repair, to change their combines, mm-hmm. which I'm, you know, not in favor of combines, but...
Yep, repairability is a factor, and if, in cars is a good example, and my understanding is...
They just crush cars now.
Well, is the people's car, Volkswagen in German, was designed so people could actually tool on it with simple, cheap tools and access their own engines and mess around with
right.
it. I think that's part of the reason people have, you know, it was so popular in recent decades to have like a Volkswagen bus because you could work on it yourself. Whereas nowadays, it's all chips, and you have to have a chip reader. And if you don't have a chip reader, you can't do anything. Even if you have one, I'm not sure you can do anything anyway.
Right.
You have to go to someplace. And so the technology is getting more and more removed from the human scale. And that's actually one definition, one important attribute of the definition of eco-villages is human scale. Robert Gilman made this definition in the early 90s. And it seems like our scale is getting further away ahead of ourselves. And so this how a computer works or how a car works or anything else is, I heard it said the other day, is like essentially magic. We don't know how it works. I couldn't fix it. I'm not even going to start to try. So it's getting further and further from the realm of something that most of humans, even in this society where we generated it from this society, are not able to actually work on those things. And so it becomes very specialized. And
because that's how I got into sustainability in the first place. Is I looked around one day when I was a kid and I went, gee, what's going to happen if this company goes out of business? Where I'm not going to be able to get water or food, or mm-hmm. you know, it's Archer Daniels Midland handles mm-hmm. whatever 40% of the fuel of the food in the world. And if something were to happen to Archer Daniels Midland, we're completely out of food. So that's how I started getting into sustainability in the first place.
I like sort of more passive, elegant styles of things. And one of them is used in permaculture is passive solar design of placing, situating a building, could be a house or a structure, in a smart way so that it's getting a lot of solar gain. That's one of the things that's unfortunate about here at Lost Valley is the buildings that were built previous to us were mostly in the woods. And so it's, you know, cedar shake sided cabins in the woods under the trees are very quaint. And they're comfy in the summer because they don't get overheated. But this time of year, basically the whole winter and more or less the fall and the spring too, they're in the shade and the cold and they need to be heated and dehumidified and things like that. So solar gain is a really important thing in this climate. In places that are warmer, you need a nicer balance of shade and sun. And so if heating the air can be done through the sun, and not having to do it through electricity or even a wood stove or anything else, that's bringing that technology layer really low. A smart design takes more upfront and can kind of pay off over a period of time, whether there's electricity or not.
Yeah, you know, what I'm looking at is, for one thing, is biological batteries, where you would use your mud, and you can even use a septic system. The bacteria in there, there's bacteria that will generate electricity. Mm. And then the other thing is, in Massachusetts, there was a gal that heated her greenhouse with rabbits. Rabbits have a 105-degree body temperature. Mm. So she was pumping the air through the rabbit cages into her house. Yeah, and mushrooms, too, I think, have a give-off heat.
And then compost piles, too. So people put compost in their greenhouses and generate more heat that way.
Well, you should run for president.
I did.
You did?
Yeah, I did in 2016. I ran for president of the United States.
So tell, what was your platform?
Yeah, so the platform is basically three planks. And one of them was what I would call environmental responsibility, the stuff that we're talking about. That was one. And the other is nuclear. No nuclear of any kind, weapons or energy. It's just too dangerous and not very smart. And the third one was more about the process itself of democratic engagement, getting people to, you know, turn off the distractions and get themselves involved with local empowerment. And so those are the three main planks. Everything else was secondary. And two visuals that I can give you. One was that the guiding metaphor, I'm a big fan of metaphors, for the campaign was a ship. Like, as a society, we are an ocean liner, a ship. But we're not out cruising in open water, and so we're grinding up onto a sandbar. And there are certain individuals seeing this happen, and they're trying to do something about it, and maybe like environmental activists who grab a paddle, and they're trying to like back paddle against it, and they're not making much headway because they're battling an engine. And then there's this, you know, debate ongoing of whether we should go slightly more to the left, Bernie, slightly more to the right, Trump, or straight ahead. But it's still basically forward direction either way. And so what was needed, is still needed, is someone to reverse the engines. And that's what I was offering, is to get in the wheelhouse and do that. Because it needs to happen from the top and the grassroots right now. We're too late, in a sense, already, so we can't wait around. And then, as far as these two main planks, I created this picture and actually had somebody create it as a drawing and put it on the website, of Uncle Sam shooting himself in the foot in two different ways at the same time. One was through an environmental destruction, as like a BB gun, where each packet of damage is very small, but it's constant, it's going all the time. And the other one is the nuclear shotgun, which is double-barreled for both weapons and energy. And that one doesn't go off very often, but when it does, it is ugly. So the first step is stop shooting ourselves in the feet. Everything else comes second.
Well, but, you know, I notice all this is, whether you believe in capitalism or communism, or all this is about the distribution of wealth, comes down to the distribution of wealth, and war seems to be the way that Orwell said the war is waged by the ruling group against its own subjects. And what he meant by this is that this is how the ruling class extracts money from the society. They keep us in poverty, and because you're spending all your tax dollars on war instead of that, and things are just blown up instead of actually being used by people. Hmm. So anything on this is not liberal against conservative. This is the little guy against the big guy, is what I notice.
Yeah, it sounds like part of what you're saying, I think, is efficiency of, like, just blowing stuff up is really inefficient. It's just a big waste.
Right. But the enemy is not liberal. Liberals. A true liberal is what we're asking for is equality.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point that you find that in the end, it's inequality that is the source of so many problems in our society. And we can see it in, we often think of that in economic terms of, you know, rich and poor. And then there's racial and ethnic components to it, too, of like the anti-racism work that's kind of happening more now maybe than it has recently. That's about inequality. Gender work as well, between men and women, inequality there. And so it's trying to rectify those things and coming back to the same level. I don't know if you ever were at the same level, but where everybody's kind of on the same plane. And that's more common in traditional societies. There are differences in power, like we talked about earlier with elders having more power than young ones, for example.
But that's checked. I believe that's checked in native societies.
Yeah, I think it's checked, and it's also necessary. At some point, you need leadership, too.
Right. Somebody needs to step up and go, we got to go in this direction. We've discussed this enough, and we need to go in this direction. We're at least try this, it in this direction.
Or we've tried it a bunch of times before, and I can tell you we shouldn't do that. We should do this other thing, or whatever it is.
Right.
But I think equality is a primary sort of symptom in our societal ill health. And that this model, as it goes further into the world, is creating more inequality. And a place that's now famous for that is India, where I'm guessing, you know, a few hundred years ago, before the modern changes, there was probably a lot more equality there. But now you can, you know, be on a street in Delhi, and you can see somebody drive by in a Mercedes next to somebody who's homeless. And that happens in this society more as well, but it's more segregated here. Usually it's not all right in your face like it is in a place like India, is well known for that. So that inequality is kind of growing around the world, it seems like, as this modern wave kind of comes over different places. And that connects to another thought for me, is the size of systems. If you have, let's say, a traditional society where you're in groups of 100 or a few hundred or a few thousand, it's hard to have a lot of inequality of power in those kind of situations. So there's a tendency to have things be more horizontal automatically. And the bigger the system, the more parts and individuals are involved in it, the more potential there is for accumulating an excess of power. And in our society, there's 320 million-ish people in one single country, which is ridiculously large. That's not viable for any significant amount of time. So there's capacity for huge accumulation of wealth. And no matter if somebody's using it, their power appropriately or not, there's always a suspicion of it because the system is kind of designed in a way that can be manipulated in that sense. Same thing with huge corporations that are now, you know, more or less governments of their own. They just aren't in one particular spot. And so that's one of the main reasons I moved to Lost Valley 10 years ago, is seeing that these huge structures like transnational corporations, like nation-state governments, even like the church and Big Ag and all the rest of it, is just too big. It's not too big to fail. It's too big to work long-term. And that the future is the past, and that is groups at a smaller level. Something like a village in traditional sense, or this kind of modern permutation on that, an eco-village or an intentional community, is something that has more hope for the future because it is similar to a model that's always worked for humans, which is more horizontal and more sort of small-scale relationship-based.
Well, you mentioned the country, I noticed the watershed in sustainability, unit of the size is you really should stay within your watershed. Mm-hmm. And there's a cycle within that watershed.
Yeah, and that's crucial as far as like natural boundaries. And a lot of the boundaries we have are artificial. Some of them are natural, like the boundary between Oregon and Washington. If you go past Portland, you cross a huge river, now you're in a different state. That one makes sense. But then if you go east far enough, you know, you're in the high desert and you cross some imaginary line, now you're suddenly in Idaho. That doesn't make sense.
Right, they just have a river is where they made the boundaries.
Yeah, or even it's just a dotted line. I mean, there's a 2,000-mile-long dotted line between Canada and the United States.
The states are square.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, and that's, you're speaking to is, basically on a watershed. Because that's the single best natural unit of things for places that aren't already islands. So a large landmass like this is best divided into watersheds, and Cascadia is one of them. So based on the Columbia River Basin, and where the water is coming from that then empties out into the ocean in Astoria. And so there are folks that are, you know, trying to move toward more of a bioregional way of doing things, and that is one bioregion.
All right, and so I'm wrapping this up. I wanted to ask you, though, I was into homesteading, and I had 10 acres out here on Lorraine Highway, but I came from L.A. originally, and in L.A., there was a museum, a guy had a sustainability, a museum that he did sustainability, and what he did, he had this exercise where he put out this grid of streets, and then he had a bunch of little toys like Monopoly pieces and just buttons and everything, and people would come in, and you would place these things on the grid. And what he was trying to show is how much you could put on a small area, because what the exercise was to be more dense rather than be spread out. So I see it as there's a balance between there, you know, for instance, the Great Plains, the farms on the Great Plains, they could back up to one another and have an open space there as the Great Plains. And even LA has the Santa Monica Mountains are a pathway for the animals. Mm. So, and I noticed, so out here, you guys are more the self-sufficiency homestead model. Anything on which is best, or is there a balance between the two?
Okay, yeah, I guess I'll first off mention that, there's a certain amount of food growing here and agroforestry and other such things, but at Lost Valley, we're still very much in the main system that we grew out of.
You guys aren't growing wheat and rice.
No, large-scale grains are difficult, unless they're large-scale.
Supposedly, there's a way to do it in a strip, but I have not seen that done successfully. So,
okay.
Continue.
Anyway,
I'm sorry.
So saying that, like, we're a few notches better than the norm as far as the mainstream of our society, and there's a hell of a long way to go to make the eco-village more eco. So, anyway, disclaimer on that front. But as far as the urban
thing
goes,
if you were isolated for a year, you might run out of food here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, way quicker than a year.
Okay. So go on, I'm sorry.
We'd all be grabbing hoes and seeds really quickly.
And I don't mean that as criticism. It's all of this is a step in the right direction.
Uh-huh.
But it's very difficult to do. Even in the 1800s, people had difficulty. You can look at the Dust Bowl disaster. People had difficulty being self-sufficient.
Yeah, and it's a challenge in our society because most of us grew up not growing food. Maybe we have a tomato plant with our mom in the yard outside, but no meaningful food production. So we don't learn that in the prime age, which is childhood. And so people are coming to that in an adult age of life and trying to go with that. So that's an inherent challenge. Anyway, back to the topic of cities. So it's a tricky situation because cities could be way more sustainable. And that is actually a permaculture author, Toby Hemenway, who wrote a book called The Permaculture City. That was his final book. And kind of going in that direction. And it can be done well.
Nancy and Jack Todd, I don't know if you know, Bioshelters and Ocean Arcs. I don't know if you know that book.
I don't know that.
All right, go on.
There's a classic example in permaculture citing Havana, Cuba, after they lost the support of the USSR when that fell. And then having to redirect really quickly and grow food all over the city, and they did. And it was a rough time, and it was a very resilient time that worked as an example for other places, and then being unintentionally cut off. So cities could be done way better and have much more grown there. And there are movements on that front, rooftop gardens and things like that. But the typical model, because we have so much fossil fuels, is, okay, you have all this really dense population here, and the food comes in from the countryside somewhere else. And the countryside could be seven states away. It might not even be nearby.
And then you bring oil from the Middle East to make the fertilizer, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not a viable long-term model, especially in places where it's difficult to grow all that much. Some place like Havana in the tropics, you can grow a lot there that you can't grow on a rooftop in Minneapolis, for example. And so cities are tricky because on the one hand, there's 7.5 billion of us at this point. We're way overpopulated. And so if we did spread out and do homesteading, like you mentioned, there wouldn't be enough space for everybody. And cities with millions of people in them is not a long-term option either. So we're kind of in this catch-22 of like, okay, we have to be in cities, but we can't be there long-term. And they are, in the short term, they're actually more efficient in ways.
I mean, most what about the waste in a city?
Yeah, there's a lot of waste in the city. But then also thinking about, like, in Manhattan, for example, most people don't own a car because it's just so expensive to have a car. And where are you going to park it and all those kind of things? So it's kind of compelled conservation in a way.
But, I mean, you could use the waste to power the city. There's no in a cycle rather than just, like London, just dump it in the street where you have cholera and things like that. There's stuff you can do with the waste. And it would be easier in a city to do it because it's right there.
Yeah, it's all right there. You could get a huge supply very easily. And so some places do burn electricity, you know, burn waste to get electricity.
Right. Well, are you guys doing biogas here? I noticed you're doing fermenting, though. What are you fermenting?
I mean, there's fermentation of foods. That's a popular one.
But you're not making fuel.
There isn't a fuel project. There's a resident here who did that for himself in California before he moved here. And we looked into it, but it was tricky to start up. And sustain like a biofuel production. That's also a question of scale, like the city that you're talking about. And so,
right, it takes a lot of
far
material
more easily when there is that scale for doing stuff of that size.
Because it takes energy and it takes material. I noticed. Like I was looking for, there's a guy up here called the Revenueer where you can buy a still. He has an alcohol still, but now you got to find like a bakery or a donut shop or something to get all the fiber. And you can't use wood because there's another process that uses sulfuric acid that you could use wood. Even beer, you can find a brewery and use the spent grain. Mm-hmm. But you have an additional process for the spent grain to make it to where you can ferment it. So, and then biodiesel is a whole other thing. You need a source of lard or something like that.
Yep. So,
and a facility like this isn't going to make enough lard.
Right. Yeah, so for example, we talked to Sequential about how did they get theirs and Sequential Biofuels, and they get them mostly from kettle chips in Salem. So they use the oil that's used in the chip production, and which is a huge volume, and they're selling a huge volume of gas at their place, so it works in that sense.
Well, there's a guy that has a biogas generator that's basically a septic tank, about the size of a septic tank. But you can't, you guys could come up with enough material to create the gas, but all you'd be able to do is cook, maybe run a generator.
Yeah, and I looked into that once. So there's methane biodigesters. There's one at Maitreya Eco Village, for example.
Right, that's the one.
Yep, and so I looked into that once here before of like doing that for our main lodge kitchen, which has a propane stove, and did some math on it and came to... First off, we'd be taking the scraps that would normally be going to our chickens and ducks we had at the time. So we'd be subtracting food from them to put into this digester, mostly kitchen scraps, I think. And then it would generate enough fuel, gas, to power one of our stoves, one burner on the stoves. And it's a six-burner stove. We don't usually use all six, but one would not be enough. So we kind of looked into that, and it was challenging on the scale of not kicking out enough, it seemed like, to maybe be worth it.
Yeah, and I mean, what about using excrement, though? I know there's a danger, again, of cholera, and the city might, the county might come down on you, too, for using that. But, you know, I'm trying to wrap it up. Yeah. That's another concept in sustainability, though, is that we have this flush and forget mentality. And you really need to take care of your own stuff. Mm-hmm. Why do you think you can just flush and just forget it? So... that's another concept I'm just saying that I think people need to learn is why would you want to be... Because one thing... I did an interview with the Mutual Aid Societies, and you're talking about driving your limo through a town of poor people. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to? And what she's talking about is, like, all your job is, and we have co-op Eugene too, and your job is as an accountant, and you don't, and that's all you do. That's all you know. So you make a bunch of money as an accountant, and then you pay other people to do all your services. Mm-hmm. Why would you really want to live like that and be dependent on other people for your services? Totally dependent on people for your other services. And, you know, the garbage man, you know, we're dependent on, if the garbage men go out on strike in New York, it shuts the whole city down.
Yeah, there's 100 different things we're dependent on. If, like, there's a glitch in the wire and your internet stops coming, okay.
Now yeah.
You have no internet.
It's over, yeah. There's a whole South Park episode on that one where the... But,
so there is a lot of dependence outside that accountant. There's a dependent on the whole rest of the world to take their little green pieces of paper to do the service they want.
And so that's what I mean, is our society, why would you want, it's not that I'm telling you, telling people what to do, it's why would you really want to be that dependent to where if the septic system goes down, you're going to get cholera. And for instance, and then I'm trying to wrap this up, but in 29 Palms too, they made everybody, they charged everybody to put a septic system in. These companies come in like in The Music Man, where he sells them band instruments, you know, or the monorail on The Simpsons. You come in, we need a monorail. These developers come in and want to put a septic system in and charge everybody $100 a month to pay for this septic system, rather than do composting toilets, where you could or a methane digester system, where you could take care of your own stuff.
Yeah, I think that's basically on the rules and, like, the state regulations and local ones, too, of, like, what has to happen. And my understanding is every house has to have either a septic or a sewer. And if they don't, you have to build it, whether you're ever going to use it at all. So you got to build, you know, $30,000 of extra infrastructure into your yard, whether you're going to use compost toilets in the end or not. So that's kind of a question of the regulations. And then going back to what you're talking about as far as the accountant of, you know, spending money for everything and not having any independence there, I think our definition of poverty is kind of off in this society, and I think a major component of it that's missed is dependence. Of how much are you dependent on systems outside yourself that you have no control over? If you're dependent on your brother-in-law to bring you his grain, okay, you know, you have a lot of power there over him, like influence him to give it to you if he doesn't or whatever, but if you're dependent on systems outside yourself, like an insurance company you've never met, it's not even a person, it's an insurance company. If your house burns down, you hope they pay you. You're not even sure if they will. So dependence on folks outside of ourselves seems like a primary ingredient in poverty that we don't count. We count dollar value. And so somebody who's living in New York City, let's say, who's making $80,000 a year, on paper looks great, but it's such an expensive place that they're burning $80,000 a year just to live there. And they have very little control over their food and water, for example. And let's say you're a campesino, like in the hills and in the Andes, growing your own food there, you have way less dollars, whatever the local currency is. But if there's some big meltdown or a global pandemic or something else, life doesn't change all that much. You know, your grains are still there. Your llamas are still there. Your other animals are still there. And so there is a certain resiliency in that system of not being so dependent. Whereas if things go wrong, this person in Manhattan with $80,000 in their hand, if they can't use that money for anything, they have nothing. So they thought they were kind of on top of the pyramid, and now they see, like, oh, I don't actually have much. And I'm expecting that to come maybe gradually over time, but that's the direction it seems like we're going in, is a certain amount of recalibration, if you want to call it that.
All right, so last question. What can people do? And the reason I ask this, too, is this is one of the things that you guys teach here, a core thing that you guys teach, is how, and you can describe it better, how in your individual life, as you are now, how can you manipulate that toward more sustainability?
Yeah.
Earth-friendly lifestyle.
Yeah, I guess
lifestyle.
My first answer, which is like kind of cheeky, is go outside and play. Sell your television is step one. And because if you're outside playing, probably with other adults and kids, it's generally a more enjoyable life, I think. And that's what humans have always been doing, is enjoying their time outside. Like, I was bouncing on the trampoline yesterday with three little kids, and that was great. And I didn't need any kind of consumption. Didn't need bells and whistles and luxury items and whatnot. We were just having a good time. I guess we had to have a trampoline to make it happen, but that's a one-time investment. And the more people enjoy themselves in that way, the less I think there is a desire to feed the need with purchased things. And the less we're purchasing, the less that we're wasting, the less that we're mining, the less that we're transporting, refrigerating, all those kind of things. And then it also being fed in a way that's not just literal. And the social sustainability and the personal sustainability. And those are angles that can be, that you can run with, that can be truly sustainable. And like, is the social relationships within a group or the personal fulfillment from things that don't require any three-dimensional items in the world. And that ends up kind of decreasing the physical need for those things as well. So kind of wrapping them all together and kind of coming back together in a sense. More so, which is the opposite of this movement during the coronavirus pandemic, which is separate. Okay, we're all sitting in our living rooms on a Zoom call, and therefore probably feeling less satisfied in kind of like deep ways that we're not noticing, and maybe more likely to fill that in with something that we bought on the internet.
All right, anything else you want to cover?
Let's see. So I guess my last thought on that, kind of on that thread of sustainability, is thinking about what is the most sustainable thing in the world. And it would not be something physical, because that would have to be created and maintained. It would have waste and things like that. So kind of playing off what I just mentioned as far as social and personal sustainability, you know, what can sustain us over time, kind of indefinitely, something that we can always make more of. And if there's too much, that's not a problem. We can always just have more. And so my current theory is that the most sustainable thing in the world is love.
Right, well, that's a great way to end it. So, but I mean...
sorry, you're listening to Colin Doyle of Lost Valley Educational Center on KUPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kupw.org. But this is just something from Brooke and Jeffrey. A radio show.
But in my family, there's no bad people. There's just people that make bad choices.
Yes.
Yeah. So, what are these, some good deeds to do? Or?
It's just to let him know, you know, sure, I haven't been the greatest this year, but you should still drop me a couple presents.
Oh.
Or else.
Oh,
or else.
That was a threat.
That's why, instead of singing the hit song by Pow Fu, Coffee for Your Head,
I love this song.
It's Young Jeffrey's Cookies for Your Sled.
Oh,
okay.
I like it.
Okay.
And Jingle Bell.
I have a special hat to commemorate the occasion.
Yay.
Let me just pull it up, put it on really quick, see if.
Oh, no. A pair of Santa's pants that you're putting on your head.
You get that.
I love it.
I hope is this still work?
Oh my gosh, it's literally Santa's like waistline and his little legs, but it's upside down.
Yeah, right. You chose the bottom of Santa to put on your head instead of most people who are going.
This is
the
part
hat.
I know best.
Okay.
So here we go.
All right.
No.
All right. I'm gonna point when I'm ready. Point. Yeah, I memorize my speech, practice what I wanna say. Because if you check the naughty list, you're gonna see my name. Yeah, sure, some things have happened, and I know that you have heard it. Elf on the Shelf's a rat, Sheriff Woody, he'll confirm it. I promise I was joking when I said I'd join a cult. I swear I didn't know that website's only for adults. Cause yeah, I'm still young and do stuff that's kinda dumb. But if you bring me presents, leave you something when you come. I baked you up some cookies, poured some milk for you, my friend. Know where daddy hides the bourbon if you'd rather drink instead. I'll try to keep this short cause you're not done with your sledding. Just like my dad's massages, hope there's a happy ending. I made mistakes all year long, things I regret. I never should have pranked my Uncle Ned by putting a tarantula in his bed. Don't fly away, oh Rudolph, know that you're mad. I said a couple sorries when I was bad, but if you brought me Legos, that'd be rad. I'm on the naughty list of that my mom made a big deal of. But Santa, please don't keep me from the Christmas toys I dream of. I took my sister's iPad, then I hid it in the park. Yeah, I had to go that far. She kept playing Baby Shark. I spent Christmas Eve hiding by the Christmas tree. Santa, where the hell you at? It's nearly a quarter to three. Oops, sorry if I cursed and I have some inner demons. But you've been watching me sleeping. How about we call it even? Let's work out some bargaining. I made a bunch of cookies for your sled, hoping it'll sway your judgment. Please don't delay, it's almost done, you might regret. I'll post a Yelp review and rip you to shreds. Convince the other kids you're not trusted. Try me.
Do what I say or it's on, is that a threat?
I'll call my dad's attorney and you can bet I'll have Santa's reindeer repossessed.
And a new hoverboard with a drone's all I request. I know that my behavior was not the best, but if I don't get toys, I'll get revenge. Santa, you made me wait for too long going back to bed. I made you special cookies for your sled, added in a drop of laxative. Santa.
Thank you.
That's it for Talk is Cheap this week. Please support the station if you can. 80 Grit is coming up next. He does some great punk rock stuff from the 80s. Don't forget to check out To the Moon and Back on Saturdays at 2, I believe it is. Elle Gaskin does a lot for the station, and she does some great stuff. The Youth Radio Project, we're doing some great stuff there. And check out the news at 1:30, I believe it is, each day. Anyway, we're doing a lot of hard work to bring you groups that are working for social change here in Eugene. And it starts with the news. So yeah, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And coming up in the next few weeks, it'll be Michael Schumann with some great solutions. As usual, that I try to bring you on Talk is Cheap. That's why I call it Talk is Cheap, because there's people out there that are actually doing something, not just complaining. All right, and I've got a bunch of requests in for interviews, so it should be a good year for Talk is Cheap and KEPW. And support the Wow Hall, too. I've got I'm digitizing a I have three shows that are recorded at the Well Hall, and one of them is Tony Levin. So I'll be digitizing that over the next week. So I'll play that for you in the coming months, too. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
This is KPW 97.3 LPFM, also simulcasting at www.kpw.org. We're happy you're listening and excited to be Eugene, Oregon's new community radio station.